why it's called systemic racism.
Sometimes we act as if inequality is a failure in the system, a failure to live up to our ideals, but it's only a failure if you think the system was really created for everyone. And what many of us are trying to say, and what I'm trying to demonstrate in this book, is no, in fact, this system wasn't set up for anyone. So when it proceeds to harm certain people for whom it was never set up in the first place, that's not failure. That's actually the system working exactly as it was intended to work. And if we don't like that, then we have to change the system.
That's social justice advocate and author Tim Wise. We talk with him about his new book, Dispatches from the Race War. Then we talk with Mehrdad Azamun of People's Action about a weapon of mass connection the organization is using to bridge the political divide. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. When Obama was elected, many white liberals thought we'd reached a post-racial America. Then came the white backlash and Trump. Then the pandemic and an epidemic of police violence against black people turned the searchlight on systemic racism and white privilege in America. While white supremacists threatened a race war, it became newly clear to many Americans that the war on black people has been going on for a very long time. My guest Tim Wise grew up as a privileged white person in the South. For the past quarter century, he's been fighting in the trenches of the race war against racism. The great scholar Cornel West has called him a vanilla brother in the tradition of John Brown. Tim Wise's new book, Dispatches from the Race War, is a collection of essays on racial flashpoints, white denial, violence, and the manipulation of fear in America today. One by one, it skewers the myths white people tell themselves about race. Tim Wise, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Dispatches from the Race War, is a collection of essays spanning since Obama's election up till now. You write in the foreword that by the time we're reading this book, we will know the outcome of the 2020 election. 81 million people voted for Biden, the most in U.S. history, but 74 million people voted for Donald Trump, the second most. The Dems lost seats in the House, and it's still not clear whether they'll be able to take the Senate. What's your take on why this was not a blue wave?
Well, I think anyone who expected it to be is overestimating the willingness of white America in particular, white men, but also white women, as we've seen in the exit polls, to actually vote in solidarity with black and brown folks. You know, for a long time, I've learned never underestimate the willingness of white folks to go into the voting booth and vote on behalf of their caste status as white people, to vote for someone who represents to them sort of what whiteness is, and to vote on the basis of white racial anxiety, white resentment, even overt hostility to others. I mean, these are white folks who went out and voted for him by and large, in spite of the fact that he hasn't improved their lives. The economy wasn't improving for the vast majority of working people to any real degree. Certainly didn't improve their healthcare situation, quite the opposite. Stood by and watched 225,000 people die while he continued to mock masking and social distancing. So the vast majority of people who have voted for Donald Trump didn't do so because he materially improved their lives, didn't do so because their bank accounts are substantially fatter right now than they were when he came in. They did so because he represents to them this symbolic referent to white masculinity, owning the libs, owning the brown folks, you know, controlling and dominating and taking us back, make America great again. This whole mentality of nostalgia, which is at the heart of white racial politics. So I wasn't surprised when Donald Trump won in 2016. I didn't think he was going to, but it certainly didn't shock me. And I'm not shocked now that, you know, 55% of white women and 61% of white men would do what white folks increasingly do. Let's remember, if it were up to white folks in this country, in 1990, David Duke would have won the United States Senate election in Louisiana. He got 60% of the white vote, in spite of the fact everybody knew he was a Nazi. If he hadn't won that one, he would have won the next year when he ran for governor, if it had been up to white folks there. If it were up to white folks, Sarah Palin would have been the vice president of the United States and possibly would have become president if McCain had gotten ill during his time in office. And if it were up to white folks, Donald Trump and his family, I suppose, would be in power forever. So I think it's a real wake-up call, I hope, to that 45% or 46% or 42% of white America that can see through this nonsense, to realize that we have a significant chunk, a majority of our people who are so desirous of maintaining control and domination in a multicultural society and saying to hell with pluralism, that we're in significant trouble, and we're going to have to recommit that 40% or 45% of us, recommit to solidarity with black and brown folks in the face of this, because there's a significant number of us who are completely on board with a kind of racial authoritarianism that Donald Trump represents.
And that's why your book, Dispatches from the Race War, is so important. First, tell us a little bit about yourself. Cornel West calls you a vanilla brother. And you write in one of the essays, or maybe it's in the introduction, you write that you always remember that moment when you first discovered the cruelties of the world, and having been ill-prepared for them, your heart broke open. Tell us about that moment and how this developed into your lifelong commitment to anti-racism.
Well, that particular piece is actually not so much about me, obviously, as it is. It's an essay in the book about my daughter, oldest daughter, on the night of the George Zimmerman verdict. And that was sort of her. I mean, she already knew sort of what her dad does, obviously, and had some sense of it. But at that time, because she was like 12, 13 years old, I think it was the first time that she had really come face to face with the way in which this country consistently lets down black people, and the justice system being just one example of that. And so it was a very emotional thing for her, because it was that, as I say in the story, you know, I was trying to comfort her, which is what parents do, telling her everything was going to be okay. And her response was, no, it's not. And the truth was, she was more prescient than me. She was more accurate than her dad in that moment. It wasn't going to be okay. And it's not going to be okay unless we commit to making it okay. So that was her sort of awakening moment. You know, in my own life, and I don't talk about this so much in this book, Dispatches from the Race War, because obviously this is an essay collection that's very much fixed in time between 2008 and 2020. But in my memoir, White Like Me, which I wrote many years ago, you know, I go into some of the details there. And, you know, I grew up in a family that, you know, made some very conscious decisions about how and where I was to be raised and what I would be exposed to. I grew up in Nashville and went to preschool at a historically black college. So I was sort of immersed in a non-dominant setting very early on in preschool. And what that did for me, you know, was it gave me a very different lens, I think. First, it subordinated me to black authority figures at the age of 3 and 4 years old. So I was having to respect black authority at a time when I think most white folks are never asked to respect black authority, if ever, certainly not in 1972. And so, you know, there I learned to be able to trust black leadership, particularly black women, to listen to what black women are telling me, whether that's, hey, clean up your desk, you know, in preschool, or whether that's, hey, this is what's going on in the world. And so later on, when I would, you know, go to college in New Orleans at Tulane, and I was a community organizer after I graduated, working in black communities with black women in leadership positions in those communities, I was in a place where I could sort of hear them. You know, I could hear them without challenging their perception of reality, which is what I think white people do most often. When black folks tell us what's up, we're like, you know, we don't want to believe it. We think they're playing a race card, they're exaggerating, they're hypersensitive. And I learned early on, like, you know, there's no reason to think that black folks don't have the common sense to know what they're experiencing, because I was immersed in a black space where I learned to respect black insight and black authority. It also meant that I was socialized in a peer group that were mostly black kids. And so when those kids would get treated differently in the classroom, and they would get disciplined more harshly, they would get tracked into the lower track classes, even though they were just as bright, or I played ball, you know, on black teams, and I would see the teams that were mostly black. And I would see the looks and the comments too, that would get thrown our way by all white teams that we would play sort of outside of Nashville. I remember going once to, you know, a semi-rural area, maybe 25 minutes outside of Nashville, and to play a scrimmage game against a team out there. And I guess, you know, they didn't know anything about us before we showed up, and we showed up and, you know, it's like all black kids and then like two of us who were white, and they just refused to play us. And as we were leaving, and this is 1980, you know, it's not 1940. And as we're leaving, they surround the car and they're screaming racial slurs at the black kids. And they're screaming a very particular slur, of course, at the white kids. You can probably imagine what that is. So that was sort of one of those moments, eye-opening moments for me, you know, at about 11 years old, where you just start to realize, wow, like this is what it is. You know, there's this line that somebody has drawn down the center of the world and the center of our culture. And I'm being told what side of the line I'm supposed to be on. And I didn't appreciate it very much.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tim Wise about his book, Dispatches from the Race War. So this collection is about what you call the core crisis at the heart of this nation. The white supremacists say that they're preparing for a race war, but you point out that the race war has been raging for 15 generations. We don't have time to go through the whole history of it, but talk about the arc of that kind of racism, how from the beginning all the way up to now, it has been so embedded in the American mind.
Well, first, let me articulate for everyone listening sort of why I wanted to conjure this imagery of a race war. It's not because I'm trying to encourage it. It's because, like you said, I think we're already in it. And the story that I tell to sort of set off the beginning of the book is about a conversation I had with a great aunt of mine years ago when I was like 25, 26 years old at a family reunion. And she, you know, looked at me. She knew what I did. I'd been out of school for about 4 years doing anti-racism work. And she was just curious. She lived in Birmingham. She's a lovely old lady. I always loved her. One of my favorite, you know, relatives of that generation. And generally, you know, pretty liberal too. But when it came to race, you know, she was like a lot of Southern white folks of that generation. That was, you know, like, yeah, she was all about FDR and she was all about the New Deal, but she really, you know, had some hangups around race issues. And she looked at me one day and she said, Tim, you know, actually she said, Tim, because she could turn my name into a two-syllable word like only Southern, older Southern women can, I think. And she said, Tim, are we ever going to have a race woa? Because she could also make war a two-syllable word, apparently. And she was really concerned. She had that look on her face, you know, that said that she thought black folks were going to start some, you know, rebellion and burn down whiteys, you know, homes. And I said, you know, no, if that's what you're talking about, I don't think so. But then I said to her, I said, and the reason I said no is because, you know, if black folks were really that vengeful, they'd have already burned the vast majority of the country to the ground a long time ago. But what I said was, I think the mistake in the question, right, is you're assuming we're not already in one. And I would say that we've been in one for a really long time. By the time our family, keeping in mind this was a family reunion that we were at, I said, by the time this family came to the United States in 1750, you know, we had already been in the midst of a racialized war, if you will, for over 125 years. I mean, 1619, as many of us know from the New York Times 1619 project this year, is the year in which, you know, Africans are first brought to Jamestown as either indentured servants or enslaved persons, but either way, virtually the same thing. And the contours of white supremacy begin to take shape and anti-blackness begin to take shape, as well as, of course, indigenous removal and genocide of native peoples. And so beginning in the 1600s, we start off with a society that is rooted in the notion of European domination. Now, we're not calling it white yet. That doesn't happen for like another 50 years or so when we really start using that term. But that's the concept. We are going to subordinate these people's bodies. We are going to take these people's lands. We have the God-given right to do it. That is the beginning of a war. And that's how it raged for a very long time. And I feel like sometimes the white supremacist of today who say we're going to start a race war, what they're missing is that their side has been fighting the war for all of these generations, whether it was enslavement, whether it was segregation, black codes, whether it was lynching, whatever it was, and all the backlash to progress that has been chronicled in Carol Anderson's brilliant book, White Rage, over the multi-hundreds of years that we've been on this land. They started this war a long time ago. And I gather that what they're upset about is that black and brown folks are refusing to surrender. You know, black and brown folks are refusing to wave the white flag and give up and continue to fight for democracy, to make democracy real, and to make consistent in this country the words and the actions. Because we've said all these lovely words, you know, Thomas Jefferson, all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Of course, Jefferson said those words at a time when he owned a couple of hundred human beings. So, and it's not like he didn't know that he owned them. So to him, there was no contradiction. He was simply saying, as were all the founders of this country, black folks ain't people. Mm-hmm. Like we don't mean them. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't incidental. And I think this is an important thing for Americans to understand. Sometimes we act as if inequality is a failure in the system, a failure to live up to our ideals, but it's only a failure if you think the system was really created for everyone. And what many of us are trying to say, and what I'm trying to demonstrate in this book, particularly in the section on historical memory, is no, in fact, this system wasn't set up for anyone. So when it proceeds to harm certain people for whom it was never set up in the first place, that's not failure. That's actually the system working exactly as it was intended to work. And if we don't like that, then we have to change the system. We don't just tinker around. We don't just elect a new guy to be the president and then think, oh, it's going to be all right now. We're still talking about a system that was constructed on the basis of the subordination of quote unquote non-white peoples. And that has to be uprooted at some level.
Yeah. I mean, and we can see that the Electoral College, for example, was erected precisely as a feature to destroy democracy. And precisely because, you know, it's no accident that this was a slave culture. Other countries that didn't have slave cultures, at least not in the same way, you know, have direct election of their presidents. You know, these essays, much of the collection is directed towards deconstructing and exploding white racist tropes, especially those coming from the right wing. But just like your aunt was a liberal of some kind, there's also plenty of racism among so-called liberals.
Yeah.
So is it that the liberals basically want to believe in the same tropes, but just in a little bit different way? I mean, is it a difference without a difference?
Well, you know, it's a difference that is a difference, but I think you're onto something, because I think that what liberals tend to think, as opposed to the left, okay, so liberals tend to have this faith in the basic institutions of the society, and therefore assume that if those institutions aren't serving everyone equitably, that, like I said a second ago, it's a system failure, and we can fix that with a little more training, let's say for cops, or a little more training for teachers, a little bit money for this program, a little bit more money for this program. And look, those things might be helpful at the margins, that money, that training, whatever it is. But if the system, if the machinery were established for the sake of producing inequality, it's a little naive to think that machinery is going to suddenly produce a product known as equality that it was never intended to produce. So I think liberals have an unjustifiable faith in the goodness of the institutions. Now, that's not to say that they have an unjustifiable faith in the goodness of people. I think that people are generally pretty good. And that's a belief that I think people can hold on to, whether they're liberal, conservative, left, right, whatever it is. You know, I think most people are pretty good. But if you're a good person caught up in a bad system, the system is more likely to change you than you are to change it, especially if you're not paying close attention to the flaws in that system. And so when I write in the book about some of that, I take some shots at President Obama, because I don't think that he's blameless in this either. There's an essay, you know, where I criticize him for something he did quite often when he was president, which was he would give these Father's Day addresses where he would simply harangue black men to be better fathers. And he would sort of fall in to this right-wing trope about black fathers and black men being irresponsible and not taking care of their kids. And actually, the statistical data says that this is almost all nonsense, that in fact, black men are much more involved in the lives of their children than anybody wants to acknowledge, and are oftentimes equally or more involved on a day-to-day basis than a lot of affluent white dads who see their kids a couple times a week because they're working 60 hours a week and don't really materially participate in their lives other than writing the checks and putting the money in the bank. But more importantly, it's Barack Obama's tendency, and he did this at a speech at Morehouse, a graduation speech that I referenced in one of the essays, where he talks about how important it is for these Morehouse men, this historically black male college, how important it is for them to take responsibility and don't blame racism for your shortcomings in life. Well, Morehouse is one of the best colleges in the United States. Morehouse men are not known for slacking off and then making excuses when they drop the ball and fail. But it was so inappropriate that he's never given that kind of talk. You know, the same year, I think it was, he gave the commencement address at Ohio State. And he didn't get up at that mostly white school and tell white folks in the crowd, hey, by the way, if you don't get the job you want, don't blame affirmative action, you know, because that's lazy thinking. Or if you don't get the job that you want, don't blame immigrants. They didn't take it, right? He didn't do that. It was as if he was saying to black folks, you need to stop making excuses, which presumes that A, black folks are given to doing that, and that B, white people never do. And it's just, it's that kind of trope that I think is very dangerous that sometimes liberal folks do in fact fall into and that we need to be aware of, because that's not helpful. That empowers this right-wing narrative that says, well, the reason that there's inequality is because the people at the bottom aren't holding up their end of the bargain, so to speak. And I think that's a very dangerous mentality.
Yeah, it focuses on the individual and not on the system. This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with anti-racist activist and author Tim Wise about his book, Dispatches from the Race War. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Talking about Obama, I mean, I never really believed that, you know, we were post-racial, like so many people said after he got elected, but I did not anticipate the backlash, at least not until I read Carol Anderson's book, which does talk so much about it. I wonder if you could talk about those Obama years, and was there a missed opportunity to develop a better understanding of racism and of, you know, ultimately of the solidarity that we need to develop among all human beings, not only on the planet, but definitely in the United States?
Well, I think the opportunity was missed before his election in a way. I mean, once he was elected, I think we all knew, those of us who do this work, that we were going to be in for at least 4, if not 8 years of white folks telling us how racism had been conquered. I mean, it started that night. You know, there were white folks who that night on television, white ultra conservatives mostly, but white folks who were saying, well, now there's no more excuses. You know, now it just goes to show anybody can make it. And of course, there were liberals, as I point out in the book, relatively liberal folks who said similar things. Oprah Winfrey said something similar. Will Smith said something along the lines of, well, you know, if Obama can become president, don't tell me that you can't get a job at the department store, you know, which is sort of this magical thinking that, well, you know, the elevation of this one person to the most powerful position means all things are now open to everyone. But in truth, you know, listen, Benazir Bhutto was elected president twice in Pakistan. I'm fairly confident sexism is still an issue in Karachi, right? Mm-hmm. Margaret Thatcher was elected prime minister a couple of times, you know, in England, and same thing. You know, many, many different countries. Germany now has a female head of state. Many countries have had, the Philippines, India, Israel. And I doubt very seriously that anyone would suggest that patriarchy has been eradicated there. But in this country, we were in store for that kind of really lazy thinking on the part of people who just didn't want to think about racism. And this became the way that they didn't have to. What I think the opportunity was missed was years and years before that, the way that we had defined racism and conceptualized it guaranteed that was going to be the response, because the way we've defined it and understood it is very individualistic. Therefore, if you vote for a black person, for instance, you cannot be racist. It's the same thing that says, well, I've got a black friend, how can I be racist? I've got, you know, first of all, most of the research says that when white folks say they have black friends, they're lying, like they're exaggerating at the very least, if not lying. They're not actually that close. It might be somebody they're friendly with at work, but they're not really within their close friendship circle. That's number one. But number two, even if you do have a Black person in your life who's a friend or a close associate, what does that have to do with anything? As a heterosexual man who's married to a woman, does that mean that I can't be a sexist? Does that mean that straight men are never sexist because they date, sleep with, and marry women? I mean, I don't think there are a lot of women who would say that, who would say, oh yeah, heterosexual men, they're never sexist because they sleep with us. I mean, come on, right? That doesn't make sense, but that's how we've defined it. And so you'll have people for years before Obama saying, well, look at these polls. I mean, you know, only 15% of white people are opposed to interracial dating now. So obviously, you know, there's no more racism. That's an extreme version of racism when you're opposed to something like interracial dating. That doesn't get at how racism manifests in the modern era. The way it manifests in the modern era is what we call white racial resentment, right? The feeling that Black people and increasingly, let's say, brown-skinned immigrants are getting something they don't deserve, that they're taking advantage of taxes, that they're taking advantage with affirmative action, that they're taking advantage of the immigration system, that they're jumping white people in line. That was actually something that we heard Arlie Hochschild's book that she wrote after the 2016 election, where she went out and talked to these white folks in small towns. That was their narrative. We feel like we've been waiting in line and these people are jumping us. Well, Black folks have been here since before white people. So they've been in line longer. Most people don't realize that, but there was a group of Black folks brought from Africa by the Spanish in the late 1500s, dumped off the coast of South Carolina, who were here. And then the Spanish fled and the Black folks were still here. So they were actually here first. They've been waiting in line just as long or longer. But to these white folks, there is an assumption, well, we deserve ours first, and then maybe y'all can get yours. And some of those brown-skinned folks who were coming from, let's say, Mexico, hell, they're just coming home. Their families lived on that land for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before we stole half of their country in a war of aggression. They're just coming home. So ain't nobody jumping anybody, but that's the mentality. That is racism too. The fact that you may have a Black buddy that you play ball with at the gym, that you may listen to Black folks' music, that you may cheer for Black ball players, whatever, doesn't change the fact that if you look at the larger Black and brown communities of the country in a negative and a hostile way, that is how racism plays out. But we didn't understand it that way. We were looking for the cross burners. We were looking for the overt races. We were looking for the David Duke type. And to the extent that Barack Obama won in 2008, even though, let's point out, he didn't win most white people. Most white folks still didn't vote for him, but a lot of them did. And people said, well, therefore, we can't have a real problem with racism. But as I talk about in, and I mention it in this book, and I mentioned it in some of my other books, at the time, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post one where they talked to some of the Obama supporters, white Obama supporters. And one of the guys interviewed said that what he liked most about Barack Obama was that he didn't have the baggage of the civil rights movement. And I found that fascinating. Like, wait a minute, you're a liberal, supposedly. And you're saying you're glad he's not connected to the bad old days of the civil rights movement. What does that tell you? What it tells me is that these were white folks who were looking at Barack Obama as an exception to a generally negative Black rule. They were saying, I don't like most of them, but that one's okay. To me, that was the most clearly stated articulation of modern racism. That wasn't a renunciation of it. That was an endorsement of it. That was saying, most of y'all are no count and I don't like you, but you know, I'll make this one my personal political Cliff Huxtable. You know, and I think that's what we did.
Right. And of course, I want to point out that the first people were here were the Native Americans, even earlier. And we are talking with Tim Wise about his latest book, Dispatches from the Race War. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for a free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio or Twitter at Writer's Voice. We're talking today with renowned social justice advocate Tim Wise about his latest book, Dispatches from the Race War. It's a collection of essays on racial flashpoints, white denial, racial violence, and the manipulation of fear in America today. I'd like to ask you about this. You say something in this book, Dispatches from the Race War, Tim Wise, that even in the early 60s, even before civil rights laws, two-thirds of whites said that blacks had fully equal opportunities. And even in the midst of the civil rights movement, they didn't really feel that there was any need for the civil rights movement. And you write that they simply didn't need to see the pain as real. And that made me take a step backward and ask myself, what is it in a human being that denies the humanity of another human being? And maybe that is a stupid question to ask, but I'd like you to weigh in on that. You've been doing this work for so many, many years. What is it that enables us to block off the pain of other people and not see them as human?
Well, first, the good news. The good news is, and I mentioned this in the section on denial, that denial is a psychological mechanism that we use to protect ourselves from judgment and to protect ourselves from pain. And so in a sense, if I know, let's say that you're in pain, there is a reason, especially if your pain is in some way linked to my advantage, right? If it's in some way linked to my pleasure, if you're losing because I'm winning and I'm winning because you're losing, which is sort of the history of America, frankly, then I've got a really clear psychological and material reason to not see it, right? Like on a material level, I don't want to see it because fixing it would require me to give up my edge over you. But psychologically too, like the good news is because I'm a good person, this is why I call it the good news, because I'm a decent person, I don't want to hurt you, right? So the good news is I'm compassionate. The good news is I'm not a sociopath. The good news is I'm not sadistic. I'm not trying to hurt you. But the bad news is that the human brain is still wired to try to avoid confronting pain. And the best way to do that is to act as though it must not be happening. Because if I have to confront it, then I'd have to do something. As James Baldwin said, if white folks really understood the truth, they'd be on the hook to make changes, and they don't want to. And they can't afford to look at it in the eye. They can't afford to look at it truthfully. I'm paraphrasing Baldwin there, but that's essentially something that he said many, many times. And so it's the idea of how do I protect myself from judgment as somebody who's gotten something I don't deserve? How do I protect myself from judgment because I've been believing in this system all this time and now somebody's showing me how ugly it is? I just can't let myself see it. I think if you look at those polls from the 60s, that's the only way to make sense of them. If you look at how white folks behaved during the period of enslavement, folks will always say, well, my family didn't even own slaves. Right. But if your family was here, what did they do to challenge the folks down the road who did? And the answer is very damn little. Like most white folks didn't own businesses during segregation either, but we shopped in those stores and we ate at those lunch counters and we went to those schools and we didn't question it. So what does that mean? Does that mean those are all horrible, evil people? No, it means that people who are otherwise decent, and this is the conundrum of human psychology, right? People who are basically decent can find themselves in horrible, iniquitous systems, inequitable and iniquitous systems, and not challenge them, because to challenge them would require them to uproot their entire worldview. And it's very hard to stand up and to admit that everything you've always thought is a lie. It's like having a crisis of faith in your religious upbringing, right? It can be really, really difficult for people. And so we're going to have to get to a place where we place a premium on telling the truth, and we link truth telling to our own healing. And we link truth telling to our own psychological well-being, because I would say there's something really psychologically debilitating about having to continue lying to yourself. Like you think about it, this election, you have all these people out lying to themselves that Donald Trump really won and that the election was stolen from him. Do any of them look healthy to you? Like none of them look emotionally or mentally healthy. I'm not trying to mock them from emotional or mental illness. I suffer from emotional and mental anxiety and depression and all kinds of stuff, right? So I'm not mocking them. What I'm saying is they don't look healthy to me. These are people who are in such deep denial about the way the world actually works, such deep denial about reality that it's literally making them mad. It's making them unhinged. And this, on a broader level, is what white America has done with racism. I think deep down, there's a part of white America that knows what has happened in this country at some level. And we refuse to stare it in the face, because to stare it in the face would cause us to rethink everything, and we're just not ready for it. But we better get ready for it, because this is tearing the country apart. And so the question is, do you want to go hard or do you want to go easy? And I think right now, the way we're going is the hard way. It'd be a lot easier to just confront the truth and get it over with, you know?
You know, and that goes to, I think, a deeper point, and this has often been also a point of contention and controversy on the left, and that is the relationship between caste and class in this country. Because as you point out toward the end of the book, and Heather McGee has written a whole book on, you know, racism is bad for everybody. Or maybe it's not bad for the ruling class, because divide and conquer has enabled them, you know, has enabled us to have the lowest rates of, you know, unionism in this country. They're doing just fine. The largest amount of inequality of any country practically on earth. But it's not as simple as to say, well, we have to focus on class because that's the fundamental reason why we have racism. But nor is it enough to say we just have to focus on identity and racism, because as you point out, you know, there's a whole lot of people out there. If we're going to build solidarity, yeah, we need to bring everybody to the same place.
Right. And the question is, how do we build solidarity? I think the biggest mistake that the traditional class-focused left, or what we could call neo-Marxist left, makes, the white Marxist left, is the assumption that if we can just point out people's, you know, economic interests and raise that class consciousness, that suddenly white working people will sort of naturally gravitate to a more progressive politic. There is literally nothing in the history of this country to suggest that that will work for a significant period of time. The reason is precisely this notion of caste that Isabel Wilkerson in her new book by that name points out so clearly is really what we have in this society. We have a society that is given to people called white a symbolic reference point, a category, a team membership that trumps, no pun intended, class status, because it gives us a sense of psychological superiority and even a sense of relative material well-being, where, and W.E.B. Du Bois called this the psychological wage of whiteness, that allowed even struggling white people to say, well, I might not have much, but at least I'm not black. And the problem for the class-focused left, who thinks all we got to do is like talk about class and that'll solve the problem, is that what they miss is the more effective they are. Like, you made a great point about the class disparity in the country. In my last book, Under the Affluence, I talk a lot about that, and the top 1/10 and 1/100 of 1% and all that good stuff that Occupy talked about and all the stuff Bernie talks about and all that. I agree with that analysis entirely. The problem is, the more effective I am at proving that to people, the more effective that the left is at showing, let's say, working class and lower middle class white folks how vicious the class system is, the assumption is that recognition will lead to class solidarity with black and brown folks. But the other possibility, and I think it's a greater possibility, is that if I'm that working class white guy, I hear that and I go, well, damn, that's a game I'll never win, man. Like, the revolution ain't coming. That's a lot of work. Like, they're so powerful. Screw it. I'm just going to cut a side deal over here. And when I say I'm going to cut a side deal, I'm going to forget class solidarity, man. I'm going to go over here and I'm going to hoard my resources as a white person, as a man, as a heterosexual, as a Christian. Like, I'm going to cleave to the identities where I'm winning, rather than trying to get with others around an identity where we're losing. And especially in this culture where we place a high priority on winning, right? We're a culture that likes to identify with the winning team, not the losing team. And so it's why every time the college wins the Final Four NCAA basketball tournament, the applications at that school go through the roof the next year. And not just from like people that want to play ball. The team only has like 12 guys, right? Or 12 women if it's women's college basketball. But like, it's people that aren't even athletes. Like, oh, now I want to go to that school. So we like to identify with winners. And if I'm telling you that you're a working class person getting your ass kicked in the class system, I'm basically calling you a loser and asking you to identify on the basis of your loserness. No, thank you. Not in this country. I'm going to go over here where I'm kicking somebody else's ass. And so the reason we have to talk about race and gender and sexuality and all those things in the same breath as class is that you can't do an end run around these areas. So I think the way that we stitch together solidarity, rather than trying to say, let's use class to get solidarity, is no, let me talk to white people about how white people right now are suffering, not just as workers. Like we could make that neo-Marxist argument, and it's true. But what about how, I mean, look, we've got white folks right now who are suffering from an opioid epidemic in small town white America, not just as workers, as white people in small towns, as the people that they are suffering because for the last 40 years, we treated drugs like a crime problem and a moral problem rather than a health problem, because it was those people, black and brown, who were being locked up. And so we didn't invest in rehab and we didn't invest in treatment. And as a result, now little nephew Jimmy John over here has got a fentanyl addiction, and little Janie over here has got, you know, a heroin addiction. So we don't have to just talk about people as workers. We can talk about them as the white folks in these small towns, who they are. We can talk about the fact that there are white families right now in this COVID-19 epidemic who are burying their grandparents or burying their diabetic spouses or worried about the health of their immunosuppressed child. And the reason is because as soon as April 7th of this year, as soon as the New York Times and the Washington Post ran front page stories about how COVID was disproportionately killing black people, that very night, Tucker Carlson goes on Fox News and changes direction. He had been saying how serious this thing was until that headline. That night, he goes on television and says, well, maybe this isn't such a big deal after all. And 3 days later, Donald Trump starts talking about, we got to open everything back up again. We can't stay locked down. We got to get the economy moving. That's not a coincidence. As soon as it was shown who the disproportionate victims were, we threw caution to the wind. Well, that hasn't just affected black folks, has it? That hasn't just affected brown folks. That's killed 100-something thousand white people as well. So we don't have to just talk about, oh, as a worker, you're being hurt. No, like as whoever you are, however you identify yourself, living in small town central PA, living in Nebraska, living in South Dakota, wherever the hell it is you live, as the white person you view yourself as, this is not healthy for you. And I think that approach where we talk about the interest convergence between the needs of black and brown folks and the needs of white folks, not by going to a different identity like class, but saying, no, staying right where we are. You think this is good for you. I'm showing you how it's not good for you in those white spaces that you occupy currently. And it's this, you know, uptick in white suicide, uptick in white opioid epidemic overdoses, uptick in white cirrhosis of the liver and heavy drinking, all of this stuff that's been called deaths of despair among white working class, non-college educated folks. The reason that's happening to those groups of people at a disproportionate rate is because they are the ones who were told, thanks to whiteness, that stuff would never happen, that the jobs would never disappear, that as long as they worked hard, there would be a job for them, that their kids would be better off than they were. Black folks knew that was a myth. Brown folks knew that was a myth. White folks were able to believe it. And because we swallowed that line, now we are ill-prepared for globalization. We are ill-prepared for the loss of jobs. We are ill-prepared for unaffordable healthcare. That was supposed to be what happened to those other people, not us. So in effect, whiteness and the expectations that come from whiteness are now responsible for killing white people. I think if we would stay right there, we don't have to dance around the issue. We can stay right there with that issue and potentially build solidarity.
Well, that's brilliant and heartening. You know, it used to be that black and whites, just talking about workers, you know, when there were unions, although not all unions, some were predominantly, still are predominantly white, but you know, industrial unions, black and white workers had experience of being together, and that's far less now. So how do we build exactly the kind of conversations and solidarity that you just spoke about in a situation where so many of us are even just physically distanced from each other?
Yeah, it makes it harder. There's no question about that. I think we need politicians who will speak to this reality, that can talk about, you know, the connectivity between the pain in urban spaces and rural spaces and ex-urban spaces. You know, for instance, you think about globalization. I mean, those plants started closing in urban spaces in the 70s. We started seeing deindustrialization after 1973, mostly in black and brown metropolitan areas all the way through the mid 80s. And of course, it was ignored because the pain wasn't affecting the vast majority of white folks. And so politicians didn't respond to it. And now, of course, those same companies have run even further. So they left the suburbs, they left the exurbs, they've left these small towns, they're moving overseas to take advantage of, you know, lower wages and less environmental and labor protections. So there's a way to talk about that to say, look, your community, even though you're not around these other folks, what you're experiencing right now, they were experiencing literally 30 years ago. And it's precisely because we didn't deal with it then that you're getting to deal with it now. So yeah, you don't know them and you don't go to church with them and your kids might not go to school with them and you don't work together, but you're experiencing something similar. And the source of the pain is the same. The source of the pain is common. I think we can talk about the same thing, you know, with regard to the housing meltdown that brought down the economy in 2009, 2010. What was that? It was the result of subprime loans that had been given to in black and brown communities for years. And then the banks were like, well, screw it. We're making so much money in the cities. Let's go to the suburbs and do this. Let's go to the small towns and do this. Start ripping off white folks too, because they didn't care. So I think we can stitch together a narrative of solidarity, even though we're not in physical proximity sometimes, just by virtue of saying, hey, you know this thing you're experiencing right now? Let me sort of, let's rewind the tape a little bit and show you, you know, who was dealing with this 15 years ago and 20 years ago. And maybe you'll start to see who your real allies are. Your real allies are not Donald Trump. Your real allies are not Tom Cotton. Your real allies are not Tucker Carlson and the folks on television, right? Your real allies are these black and brown folks that you've been dismissing and not listening to. And meanwhile, they were the ones who were in the hull of the Titanic yelling up to the top deck, hey, this boat's going down. Right? That's what they were doing. And you weren't listening because you were eating caviar, doing whatever, listening to, you know, orchestral music and thinking, oh, this boat's not going down. What are y'all talking about? And they knew much better than we did.
We only have about a minute left, but I don't want to go away without talking about George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and what we saw this year, because you say there was something different about it. And I wonder if you could talk about, you know, what happened? Why did we see so many white people in towns so predominantly white supporting Black Lives Matter? And do you feel that it's something enduring or is it already over or was something different happening that we can build on?
Well, the long-term nature of it will be up to us to determine. It's unclear at this point. But I think what made it different, because, yeah, look, what we saw happen to George Floyd, we saw happen to Eric Garner, we saw happen to Alton Sterling, we saw happen to John Crawford, we saw it happen to Tamir Rice, we saw it happen to Laquan McDonald. I mean, other folks have been killed on camera by cops, and it didn't lead to this level of uprising. What I think caused this to be different is precisely because we're in this COVID lockdown moment, we have a certain degree of isolation from the noise of the regular world. We're at home more. We're not going about the normal routine the way we normally would. So there's less background noise for most of us. And I think that allowed a lot of white folks in those key months during the summer to really focus in and see things they hadn't seen before, hear things they hadn't heard, and feel things they hadn't felt, as opposed to hitting the snooze button on the alarm clock yet again. Now, the question is, are we going to crawl back into bed and go to sleep? Are we going to stay awake and doing the work? I don't know the answer to that. I think we need to have a long-term strategy, though, and remember something. The biggest enemy of long-term sustainability is cynicism. And the reason I say that, I've heard some people in the last couple of months, you know, who've said, oh God, you know, the movement is already flagging. Look, like the energy's draining. There haven't been any demonstrations this week or for the last 3 weeks. And it's like, wait, slow down, calm down, remember something. When the sit-in movement hit in Nashville, well, starts in Greensboro, Feb 1, 1960. 2 weeks later, it hits here in Nashville. And within a couple of weeks, it's all throughout the South. When that happened, nobody knew what was going to come from that. Nobody knew what that was going to lead to. To now think, oh my God, you know, these uprisings in June were huge and now there's nothing. We're only like 5 months in. That would be like going back to, you know, what, like July of 1960 and saying, oh man, the civil rights movement is dead. Trust me, it's not dead, right? This is a long-term struggle. Folks are planning and strategizing and coming up with battle plans right now. And now that we're going to get on the other side of this election, hopefully, we'll be able to turn our attention after January, because those Georgia Senate races are obviously a big deal. But after that, we can turn our attention to the grassroots mobilization that I think deep down we all know is the key to making any politician of either party do what needs to be done. That's going to require continued sustained pressure. And I think that we're up to it, but we'll see. It's going to be up to us to make that clear.
Well, Tim Wise, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about your wonderful book. It's a collection, Dispatches from the Race War, and for this terrific conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Social justice advocate Tim Wise. He's the author of 5 books, including Under the Affluence and Dear White America. This is Francesca Rhiannon. I recently had a conversation with Mehrdad Azamun, the senior political strategist for the nationwide grassroots coalition People's Action, talking about the successful new organizing technique they're using, deep canvassing. I've posted the entire conversation at the Writer's Voice website as part of our online series, What You Need to Know. But here's the first 5 minutes or so of it. Is America hopelessly divided between those who voted for Donald Trump and those who voted for Joe Biden? Or can a weapon of mass connection be used to bridge the divide? That's a bet being made by a national economic and racial justice organization called People's Action. It's a coalition of grassroots groups operating in 30 different states on issues like climate justice, student debt, mass incarceration, healthcare, and housing, and in mobilizing voters to turn out for those issues. The weapon of mass connection People's Action uses, maybe a better word is tool, is something called deep canvassing. I spoke with Mehrdad Azamun, national political strategist with People's Action, about deep canvassing and its impact. Mehrdad Azamun, tell us about deep canvassing and why it is effective, as you claim that it is.
What's very clear is that nowadays in our politics, people are really striving for meaning. And part of the reason people can be turned off by politics is it can seem so cynical, so transactional. And obviously, as we've seen during the Trump era, it's really just full of brazen attacks and just a gross polarization. And if you're not with me, then that means automatically that you're against me. And if you haven't signed up for every single thing that I believe, then somehow you're a bad person. And it's very easy for people to get backed into the corners of political life that way. Deep canvassing is very different in that it's just a simple engagement tactic that we call, a colleague from San Francisco used this term, is that it's a weapon of mass connection. It is not transactional in nature, it's transformational. And it's both for the person who is doing the canvassing and the person being canvassed. And it relies on not a 2-minute drive-by conversation of, hey, are you going to vote for Trump or Biden? Are you going to vote for this or that candidate? All right, you're with us. Okay, you're against us. Goodbye. It actually forces both people to actually have a deeper conversation that is non-judgmental in nature and has both people actually share stories. So it is it's warmer, it is more relational, and it actually touches on the points of tension, especially the person being canvassed may have, notions that they may have in their head or their story or their life story about whatever issue is being discussed, whether it's a candidate or a particular community issue that's happening. So we saw it as an incredibly effective and way more meaningful way to actually connect with voters in this election cycle. And we think the results of our political program really show that as well.
So what were those results?
So it's pretty stunning what we were able to do. We actually weren't even clear that we could reach these kinds of metrics, but we engaged in the end over 35,000 volunteers who made in the end about 2.2 million phone calls and had, between all the different states that we were calling into, about 280,000 deep canvas conversations all around the country. And we would ask the voter, and we were calling mostly conflicted voters in these cases, on a scale of 1 to 10, where do you fall in voting for Trump or voting for Biden? And so number 1 was a strong Trump, number 10 was a strong Biden. And what we saw is that we had a so-called 49% movement rate, which meant that on that scale from 1 to 10, the conversations moved folks at least one notch towards Biden. So we're really happy that like half of the people that we were talking to, the conversations had some kind of effect. And it's not just that we were able to move half the people somewhat towards Biden. We had, of the people that we spoke with, 21%, we were actually, if they were either anti-Biden or completely undecided, we had a 21% persuasion rate, which meant that about 1 out of every 5 people that we talked to who was either against Biden or neutral on Biden, they were actually pro-Biden by the end of the conversation that we had with them.
So that's impressive. But how many people who are, let's say, in the 1 to 4 universe, closer to Trump, were you able to move? And is it possible to talk to people who are Trumpists?
Yes, it is absolutely possible. There were many people that we spoke with who were couldn't have been more pro-Trump. Even those people that we spoke with, they really appreciated the conversation. And our volunteers would also self-identify and they would say, well, you know, personally, I'm like an 8 or a 10. I'm like completely pro-Biden. But the fact that we could actually have a conversation that ignored pundits, that didn't involve, are you a Fox News viewer or a MSNBC viewer? They just really appreciated having a cooled off conversation in which two people could just share stories. And even if they came out saying, you know, we actually don't agree on this particular candidate, but we actually agree about all these other things, folks really appreciated having that kind of non-judgmental conversation.
Listen to the rest of that conversation with Merdad Azamun at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.